It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we take a peek behind the late-night TV screen with a veteran Tonight Show writer.
First, Governor Walker is getting a lot of attention for his suggestion this week that the United States may want to consider cutting back on legal immigration.
Walker admitted last month on Fox News that he had changed his stance on undocumented immigrants. 2 years ago, he argued for offering them a way to become citizens. He said in that interview he no longer supports the idea.
He now seems to be taking his stance on immigration a step further in comments that he made while talking to conservative radio host Glenn Beck. Here's what he had to say.
And then in terms of legal immigration, what we need to approach that going forward is saying we will make adjustments. The next president and the next Congress need to make decisions about a legal immigration system that's based on, first and foremost, protecting American workers and American wages, because that, the more I've talked to folks, I've talked to Senator Sessions and others out there, but it is a fundamentally lost issue by many in elected positions today, is what is this doing not only to American workers looking for jobs, but what is it doing to the wages? And we need to have that be at the forefront of our discussion going forward.
This stance could be problematic for him in his likely Republican presidential primary because many Republican donors, including David and Charles Koch, support legal immigration in part for business reasons.
Here with us to talk about Governor Walker's comments is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you frame Governor Walker's comments on legal immigration for us? Where did he make them, and what was the background?
Well, basically, he made them on Glenn Beck's program, and he's sort of followed them up in some interviews. And, Beck is clearly on the conservative side of the Republican Party. I mean, he wouldn't even consider himself a Republican, probably. He'd probably consider himself outside of the party apparatus. And to Beck's audience, Walker is making a lot of sense. If you look at polls, it indicates that the people most likely to be against legal immigration are those independents who lean Republican. Of course, however, they don't make up a majority of the Republican Party, and that's a big problem for Walker, as you indicated, because it turns out that most Republican voters simply do not want to decrease the amount of illegal immigration. And it's not only the voters, but it's also the party actors, the elected officials. And when you're looking at a primary going forward in which there's very little ideological difference between the candidates, voters tend to look to those elected officials to decide who to vote for. And if they don't like Walker on this position, it could be a trouble going forward for him.
Well, and a couple of years ago, Walker made the case for a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. Now he's talking about having reservations on legal immigration. Was this a surprise that he's seems to be moving to the other end of the spectrum on this?
Well, I don't really, when you're running for president, it's one thing than running for governor, right? And you're running for president and you're running in these early states, especially Iowa, which is a caucus in which there are going to be very few voters turning out. And you're trying to appeal to this conservative portion of the electorate. Remember, there are going to be a ton of Republicans running. And so if you really only need 20-25% to win, then Walker might be making the bet that in order to appeal to that most conservative part of the electorate, the most likely to turn out, that these types of positions on immigration will be beneficial to him. I don't believe that's very good calculus, because even if you win in Iowa, usually the winner in Iowa doesn't actually win the entire primary. You have to go to New Hampshire, which is much more moderate, and then South Carolina, which is kind of in between the two of them. And so for me, it's just not a wise position looking at the polling and looking at the response from different senators. Remember, he mentions Jeff Sessions, but there are 99 other senators in the United States Senate. There are a ton more Republicans besides Sessions. And most of them, in fact, there isn't a single other Republican who has been vocal about wanting to decrease the amount of legal immigration. It's just, in my opinion, not a smart move.
And you point out in the polling that there's a difference between saying you want to roll back legal immigration and holding it at a constant rate. What's the difference there?
Right. So, it would be one thing if Walker were saying, look, I want to look at this issue and maybe we should keep things the same. We don't want to keep bringing people into this country, even if they're here legally. But he's not saying that. I mean, he's not really saying much of anything, is he? He's sort of wavering on it. He's kind of giving a nice little wink to Beck and his audience and trying to place a little middle ground. But it doesn't take a real genius to look at his comments and say what he's really talking about here. And decreasing is just, it is a minority position within the Republican Party, not only among the party actors, as I spoke about, but also among the voters. If he had said, we want to stay steady, that, in fact, is a perfectly reasonable position based upon the polling numbers.
We're talking right now about Governor Walker's recent comments on legal immigration with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. And one of the suggestions in that soundbite that we heard is that legal immigration might depress wages. And that's something that's contentious. What do we know about the effect of legal immigration on wages?
Well, I think it's exactly what you said. It's contentious. It's not very clear. And when things aren't very clear and you can't present clear facts in front of a primary audience, that's a big problem. You know, if it was one thing that was very clear that wages would get decreased, then Walker would be in very, very good position because he'd be able to put those up on ads and he'd be able to make his case and it would be clear as night as day. But when things aren't clear and things are muddled, as they often are in primaries, where ideology is just not that clear. I mean, it's one thing to say, I'm more conservative than Hillary Clinton, right? But it's another thing to say that I'm more conservative than, say, Marco Rubio. And when things just aren't clear and facts aren't clear and you can't present your argument very, you know, on a basis of I'm definitely right here, that's a big problem for him when you have the entire other part of the Republican Party against him.
Right, and there does seem to be general agreement that immigration as a whole is good for the economy, according to the Washington Post and other sources. Is it possible, though, that this would work appealing to people who would like to see a candidate move further to the right?
I mean, of course. You know, it's one of those things whereby there's going to be a portion of the Republican Party that is going to like what Walker's saying. Remember, about 40%, depending on the polling, 35 to 40% of Republicans want a decrease in legal immigration. So he could appeal to those voters. But again, when you're trying to put together a majority of voters in a Republican primary, when you start getting these candidates eliminated, look, we're going to start off with probably about 10 Republicans. But then once you get through with South Carolina and Florida and you get to Super Tuesday, it's going to limit the field to, you know, two or three candidates. And just being able to appeal to 40% of the public on this issue is just not something to me that's a smart move. I think there are a lot of other issues that are out there for Walker in which he could be able to appeal to the Republican base besides this one that, of course, when you're dealing in a long primary and you have donors that are going to spend candidates into the ground, you just don't want to go against the donors, as you mentioned, the Koch brothers and a whole ton of other donors as well who don't want legal immigration to be limited.
Well, who should Scott Walker's primary audience be right now? Should it be likely Republican voters or should it be donors and current politicians who could help him?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, you know, we're still so far away from the primary, right? Candidates going to switch positions, and you're going to see, you know, voters say, you know, I want one candidate, and they want the other. And the people who don't forget, though, are the party actors and the donors. These are the types of people who are smart, who are paying the most attention, who are going to choose candidates within the next couple of months who they want to get behind. And you don't want to upset them. And something like legal immigration, which has, as we have hinted at and we've said throughout this entire interview, has major economic repercussions. That's the type of thing that can get donors very, very upset very quickly, and you don't want to alienate them, especially in this era of super PACs where they can spend tons of money and Walker could just be outspent by millions going into the primary season.
Well, you mentioned donors Charles and David Koch. They've expressed support for Governor Walker in the past. Have they responded at all to these comments on legal immigration?
I haven't seen them respond specifically to Walker's comments, but we do know that they have been very forceful. They do not want to see a decrease in the amount of legal immigration, and that's just a position that's pretty much uniform among the donor class. They believe that it is good for the economy and especially good for their wallets, and so if Walker tries to make more of this than he already has, it could be a big problem for him.
So it's early in the race. I mean, so early that, you know, Scott Walker is not even announced yet. But do you see this as something that has the potential to seriously hurt his potential candidacy already?
You know, it's one of these things whereby it's not just one issue. It's issue on top of issue on top of issue. And, you know, Walker has on immigration, whether it be illegal immigration or legal immigration, you don't really know where he stands. And the positions that he has switched to are positions that aren't very favorable to those who are in the donor class or many of those who are part of that Washington establishment. Remember, Walker is this rather conservative governor from the Midwest who isn't that well known in Washington, and his image is coming up and it's forming. And the last thing that you want is somebody who's a flip-flopper and someone who is seen as very, very conservative. And that's the type of thing. Look, if this was just a one-off type of thing for Walker, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But now you're starting to get this image of somebody who isn't just very conservative, but someone who flip-flops to the more conservative positions. It's not a place that I would want to be. I'd get off of it if I were him.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, about Governor Walker's comments this week suggesting that the U.S. might consider cutting back on legal immigration.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Johnny Carson reigned as the king of late-night TV for three decades. Ever since first stepping onto the Tonight Show stage in 1962, Johnny and those who followed quickly became household names.
As more and more people tuned into late-night TV for a humorous spin on the news, TV hosts got to shape what Americans thought and talked about.
In fact, our next guest, a veteran late-night TV show writer, says a lot of the nation's cultural and political discourse has been shaped by late-night TV.
With us now is John Max. He was the top writer for the Tonight Show for 22 years. He's the author of Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here, and I love the fact that you played a Here's Johnny. I thought it was about me. I was very excited when I heard that.
Here's Johnny Max.
There you go.
Well, you worked on late-night TV. You wrote for late-night TV a couple decades plus. What makes late-night television and those monologues so influential in shaping, you know, what we're talking about, what we think about the news?
Yeah, I call it the, it's really a three-parter. I mean, the first one is it amplifies. You see a small story, something in the news, it's funny to a comedy writer, it goes on late night TV, whether it was on Dave or Jay or Johnny or any of the Jimmys or whoever, and it's amplified. All of a sudden, something that might have been in a local scandal or a local story becomes national. The second thing it does is it filters. I mean, in this day and age when we have how many news stories crossing our desk, how many, this alert just coming in on our smartphones, it gives a way to, you know, the 25 jokes or the 10 topics that a late night show puts on the air. In essence, those late night hosts are filtering it down to saying, these are things that are of interest that you might be interested in. And the other thing, and the final thing it does, and this is especially true with politics, is it paints a picture. I mean, I was listening to your broadcast earlier talking about Scott Walker. And, you know, very few people nationwide know about Scott Walker. If the late night hosts start to paint him as this person or that person, that may take hold. And we've seen that time and time again.
Now, you said that this take on the news, taking it, packaging it, figuring out what people want to hear, is something that wasn't always obvious, that Johnny Carson is kind of the guy who figured that out and ran with it. What made him sort of the king of the monologue?
He invented the monologue as we know it today. His predecessors of the Tonight Show, Steve Allen and Jack Parr. Steve Allen was more sketches and bits, and Jack Parr was more conversation and stories. But Johnny is the one, and starting in 1962 with his very first joke, which is actually about former Vice President Richard Nixon, that it became about the people in the news. It became about public figures. And he made that, and since he was the one, he was the king. He was, a number of people came up to try to take the throne, but Johnny really dominated. And we got used to, as Americans, to watching a monologue and expecting that person. Plus the fact he was a Midwesterner and he kind of spoke for the whole country. It wasn't one skewed, West Coast, East Coast point of view. He kind of, he represented every man. And every woman. And I think that's what made it so powerful and influential.
As a writer of these monologues, what is it that tripped your radar? What were you looking for that said, this is the twist on politics, or this is the obscure story that's going to make a good monologue line?
For the bigger stories, I was always looking about for two things, especially when it came to a politician or celebrity. I would always look for, what's stupid about this? What did they do stupid? Or what did they do hypocritical? You know, a politician who rants and raves about returning moral values to our schools who then gets caught with, three sheep and a woman not his wife, okay, that's hypocrisy. And in terms of the small stories, You know, the day I'd always look for just the obscure people, the funny people, the man in Belgium, I used to call it, who got caught, you know, hugging a tree, and was arrested. I'd look for the odd things that we'd all laugh at. So I always try to make the jokes about public figures go up to those more powerful or richer than us. And when it would go for someone not more powerful or richer, it would be the odd story, that somebody who's a little bit odder than and out of the norm.
We're talking right now with veteran writer John Max about late night TV's influence on American life and American culture. We're going to fast forward now. Here's a clip from The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon, where he's writing out his famous thank you notes.
But anyways, do you guys mind if I write out some weekly thank you notes? Is that cool? You guys are the best. James, take us some thank you note writing music, please. Thank you. Summer barbecues. Being a great way to invite some friends over for a fun afternoon of not knowing when to ask people to leave. Thank you, sliced bread, for coming out the same year that the television was invented. But let's go with you being the best thing to happen since 1928.
So one of the Johnny Carson successors there, Jimmy Fallon, interesting thing about him, you say he sort of talks less than any of the other hosts. What do you make of that?
What I do is Jimmy knows history. What I'm so – I admire him so much is he's taken the show that existed really for since 1962 – and that Johnny started and that Dave and Jay took, took over, and he's made it his own. He knows his strengths, and his strengths are sketch, variety, comedy. He's not going to do a 25-joke monologue like Jay. He's not going to go do, a monologue in a top 10 list like Dave. He knows what his strengths are, and when he has what I call great renewable bits. You have to feed the monster. You're doing, 240 shows a year or whatever. You have to keep those jokes coming. And when he has a thank you note, when he has a lip sync battle, when he has two, celebrities playing Pictionary or slow jamming the news, he's got great renewable bits that are really entertaining.
So the game is different now. Johnny Carson was the one you watched, I guess, back in the day. Now all the networks have their late night talk shows, and there are more networks, cable networks too, and lots of other viewing options. How has that changed what we're seeing at night?
Oh, well, first of all, we're the only three people, the two of you and me, that don't have a late night show right now. And it's a little upsetting, but I suspect we will all get one. What's happened is this. I mean, with Johnny, you had, 10, 12 million people watching, and with Dave and Jay, you had, 4 and 5 million. Now, Jimmy probably has about 4 million watching him at night, but what you have is you have options for everyone. If you want to get, a more political monologue, and political jokes, you're going to watch Bill Maher. If you want to see more sketch comedy, and variety and great celebrity interaction, you're going to watch Jimmy Fallon. If you want to watch a monologue, you're going to watch more traditional, you're going to watch a Seth Meyers or Conan O'Brien. There's really there's something for everyone. We have, it's the old 500 choices. They used to say 500 channels and nothing on. Well, in this case, you've got, 10, 15 hosts, and there's a lot on the watch.
Okay, so talking politics some more, you say that a crowd's response to late-night TV jokes a week before an election can predict its outcome. Really?
I always say that voters are really smart and the audiences are really smart. And what you would do is this. I would watch our audience and I would watch the reaction to jokes. And when a politician's name is in the setup, that's one thing. When the politician's name becomes the punchline, when it's a joke about something totally different, and then somehow it ends up being a joke about an Al Gore, and that's the punchline, or years past before that, a Dan Quayle, that's really bad. And I'm never forgetting 2008. It was right after the Democratic convention, the Republican convention was coming up, and Barack Obama was kind of an unknown, and you can see people were laughing more at the name. They're not because the name is not, it's not Jim Smith, but the idea of he and Biden, it was people, you could tell they were laughing, they were a little unsure. And then September 15, 2008, John McCain comes out with a statement that the economy is fundamentally sound the day that Lehman Brothers collapses and the economy goes in a tank. And all the late night hosts, went wild on that. And you could just tell that the audiences were laughing. You'd mention John McCain's name and they go, yeah, he's just not who we want as president. And you could tell then that the numbers were going to start to slip for him and the Obama rocket took off.
Does it ever go too far? Do you hit a point where you're caricaturing someone, piling on, and it's disproportionate to the laughability of, say, a politician?
You know, my theory in that, Rob, is this, that if the audience doesn't laugh, you're just not going to do those jokes. You know, you've got, with the people that host these shows, you've got the best in the world. And they're not going to try to sell something that you're not buying. So, you know, again, I can't sell you a joke that Stephen Hawking's not smart. And, you know, but I can sell you a joke. I can tell a joke that's going to laugh that maybe Sarah Palin's not really ready for discussing foreign policy on a world level. That's believable. And if you go too far, if you stretch it too much, it's not going to get the laugh. Plus, one thing about Jay, he had what I call the mafia rule. He never touched the family. So Bill and Hillary Clinton were always good, but Chelsea Clinton was off limits.
Well, as we look ahead to whatever's coming next in late night, what do you consider the last sort of undiscovered countries in late night, briefly here?
Undiscovered country by as in areas to tap? Well, I mean, to me, it's I am still befuddled by the fact, and I never use the word befuddled, but I just used it there, by the fact that there's no woman hosting a late night show. There, you know, I love Wanda Sykes when she had a show a few years ago. I can't understand why she doesn't have a show now. Amy Schumer is one of the great talents in comedy. I think she's fantastic. I know she does have a show, but I'd love to see her have a show in a traditional talk show. You know, Amy Poehler. I mean, Amy makes $7 gazillion a year doing movies and TV, but she'd be fantastic. So to me, that is something that I was really stunned that a woman wasn't named either to take over The Daily Show or to take over for Letterman. And so basically, I'm waiting for when Chelsea Handler comes back on the air.
John, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you so much.
We've been speaking to John Max, the top writer for The Tonight Show for 22 years. His book is called Monologue.
The latest Wisconsin survey from WPR, WPT, and St. Norbert College is out this week. The survey looks at policy, politics, the economy, and more. Right now, we'll take a closer look at how Wisconsinites feel about the economy and both their own economic outlook and the state's. One of the take-homes, the number of Wisconsinites who feel confident in Wisconsin's economy has gone down since the previous poll, even though many of us are optimistic about the economy on a personal level.
And when asked if they were financially better off or worse off than a year ago, responders showed a slight uptick from last time around. Kevin Quinn is with us now. He's an economics professor and dean of the Schneider School of Business and Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Kevin, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Well, what do you think of the latest results here, gauging how Wisconsinites think Wisconsin's economy is doing?
Well, this is part of a trend that's been going on for some time, not just here in Wisconsin, but nationwide. It's been a long, slow, but actually reasonably steady crawl out of the hole over the last several years. For some context, Wisconsin, I think, recently only regained the employment level that it had before the recession. I mean, only in the last, you know, month or two. So, yes, things are better, definitely, than they were, but they were pretty bad. They were pretty bad for a while. And that's reflective of how people are feeling nationally as well. There's some signs of life in the labor market. Of course, you know, if you look at monthly data, you can get confused because one month is up, one month down. There's a lot of revision. But generally speaking, for quite a few years now, the trend has been up. The thing that's been interesting is that up until fairly recently, that's not been the narrative. Most folks have not necessarily felt that things were getting better, even if the numbers were showing that they were getting better slowly. I think what we're seeing is people's sensations about how the economy is doing is beginning to catch up with how it's actually doing.
There was a dip in how people rated Wisconsin's economic condition this time versus the previous time the poll was taken. That's just two data points, but is there something that's going on either in reality or in our perception of reality that makes us less confident about the state's economic direction?
Well, in the fall, of course, we heard a lot of stuff related to the governor's election one way or the other, and in general, I think that the narrative that won the day was that, you know, the Wisconsin economy was doing better. And I think that is consistent with the results that we saw in the election. Since then, though, there's been a number of things I think that have impacted that. One is we have had a very public debate about various elements of the budget, particularly with respect to the University of Wisconsin system. And people are becoming more aware that the budget is not in great shape. So you put those two things together, and I think, and plus the governor has not been in the state to be making the case to the state. He has a different goal now. So it's not too surprising that he's taking a beating in some of these public opinion polls, and that is reflected in how people feel about the economy.
And so nationally, the economy seems to be stabilizing. That seems to be reflected in these numbers. And yet, as Rob said, Wisconsin economic outlook, people feel not so sunny about it. Is it unusual to have a bit of a disconnect like that?
Well, the Wisconsin economy is constructed a little bit differently than the U.S. economy. We're very heavy manufacturing compared to the rest of the country, and you know we have more agriculture, et cetera. And that's even true compared to some of our neighbors. So what we feel a lot is what's happening in the manufacturing economy. And while manufacturing has come back compared to where it was before, we haven't seen the kind of growth in the manufacturing sector that we've seen in some other sectors of the economy, healthcare and education, professional services, et cetera. So I know that there's a whole debate about how is Wisconsin doing compared to Minnesota, and you know either side wants to kind of point to various things. But the real reason why the Minnesota economy has for quite a long time outpaced the Wisconsin economy is that it's constructed differently than we are. So, yes, it's true that a rising tide lifts all the boats, but some boats have different anchors on them than others. And right now, because of Wisconsin's economic composition, we are not likely to see the kind of roaring back that maybe you would see in some other economies. For example, we don't have a lot of oil here. And, you know, North Dakota did. So they boomed like crazy. And now that oil prices are down, they're getting hurt. So, I mean, the more you sort of disaggregate it, the more differences you're going to get between the national economy and the regional economy.
Talking to economist Kevin Quinn from St. Norbert College, looking at the most recent Wisconsin survey results having to do with the economy. Kevin, I always wonder, as a state, to what extent are we captains of our own boat in this economic ocean we live on? How much does Wisconsin control? How much do policymakers control how well the economy is doing? How much are we at the mercy of what's going on in the rest of the country, the rest of the world?
Well, in the short run, I think there's a lot more credit given to policy than really is deserved. In the longer run, that can be different. I mean, when we think about the kind of investments that the state can make, whether it's in roads or education or health care or, I mean, whatever, you know, lower taxes, those things do not have immediate effects. Companies do not relocate, you know, on the drop of a hat. The effect that roads have on, on the transportation infrastructure and its economic impact takes a while. The impacts that we put into education take a very long time. So what we really are seeing, and then there's just accidents of history. You know, Wisconsin had a lot of the right things for agriculture and for manufacturing at the time where people who were interested in that sort of thing were coming here. So that's part of the reason why we got good at it and we concentrated in it. So now that said, over a medium term, policy can have a big difference. What is that? Is that 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years? It's hard to say. So I think one of the issues that's happening right now with the economic debate in the state is have we made the right kind of investments in the past? Should we, you know, do something different with our tax structure, with the way we spend money, on education, et cetera? Would that be better for us to do? But we won't know the answer to that for 20 years, probably.
And Kevin, you're right. The compare and contrast thing between Wisconsin and Minnesota has been pretty front and center this past year, especially with some people pointing at Minnesota going, how come they're doing so well? But you said Minnesota's economy is structured differently or constructed differently. What do you mean by that?
Well, they have a lot more emphasis on health care. They have more emphasis on these services, and nationally, the trend has been for those things to do. There's been growth, particularly in employment in those areas, and so as a result of that, they've been on the good side. Now, if for some reason manufacturing would have boomed and healthcare and professional services would have been in trouble, the story would look very different. Now, you could make an argument that the reason why they're constructed like that versus Wisconsin is that many, many years ago, there were conscious decisions made from a policy point of view to invest in health care, to invest in education, and to de-emphasize certain kinds of manufacturing. That's a question that would be up for debate, but you could construct an argument for they are now reaping the benefit of the policy choices that they made maybe even in the 80s and before.
A lot of the discussion we hear about the economy, it kind of depends on where somebody's coming from a partisan angle. So critics of Governor Walker say, hey, our job growth in many quarters isn't looking that good compared to the rest of the Midwest, the rest of the country. His supporters and the governor himself point toward relatively low unemployment here in the state. How do we sort that out? Are they both valid arguments? What makes more sense than the other?
Well, in many ways, it's kind of like that dress that was flying around social media a couple of months ago where everyone saw a different color. And there's a lot of confirmation bias here. And we are helped greatly by choosing to get our news and information from different types of media sources. So if you are on Team Red, you point to a collection of statistics and factoids that support the fact that, Governor Walker and the Republicans are doing great and having wonderful impacts on the economy. If you're Team Blue, you point to a different set that, look like things are doing terribly. The fact is you have to look at all of the stories. If you ever want to lose faith in humanity, you just have to go to the comments section of your local online newspaper. And people aren't even talking to each other. They're talking past each other. They're repeating talking points here and there. The fact is that there's no such thing as completely black or white. Most things are gray. Most things are beige. And, I mean, the bottom line here is this, that the Wisconsin economy has been growing, but it has been growing slowly compared to other parts of the country, perhaps partly from policy. I do think that there has been an impact of reducing the amount of spending that the union workers had. I think that had an impact. I think that's an immediate impact. The argument that you could make is, well, that's an important investment for the future. So, I mean, but most of it is structural more than anything else. So as a result of that, you can pick certain numbers that say, different things. Here's a great example. In the most recent information that I saw, the Wisconsin unemployment rate dropped to 4.7%, right? Well, that sounds great. Well, actually, there were 5,000 fewer jobs than there were in March than there were in February. Well, why is that? Well, labor force participation went down. Well, why is that? Well, we can blame the national policy, when in reality, the bigger story is that as the baby boomers retire and as there are fewer young people entering the workforce right away, we are seeing a long-term downward slide in that. So it goes back and forth and over and over and over again. I mean, the big picture is there that Wisconsin is limping along. We have budget issues that they're trying to resolve right now, and they're ugly. They're not fun. We are not in a booming economy, but we're also not in a free-fall economy like we were, 5 or 6 years ago.
We're talking about the latest results from the Wisconsin survey from WPR, WPT, and St. Norbert College. Talking now with Kevin Quinn, economics professor and dean of the Schneider School of Business and Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere.
And we want to hear from you. How would you rate Wisconsin's economy? How about compared to last year? Why do you think more Wisconsinites seem pessimistic about the state's economy than last fall? And from where you're sitting, what is your personal financial outlook looking like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the results from the Wisconsin survey from WPR, WPT, and St. Norbert College. Right now, we're taking stock of how survey respondents in the state feel about the economy and their own financial well-being. Talking with Kevin Quinn, economics professor and dean of the Schneider School of Business and Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere.
And we want to hear from you on this. How would you rate Wisconsin's economy? How is it doing, do you think? Do you think it's on the improving side of things, maybe compared to last year? Why do you think more Wisconsinites seem pessimistic, according to the survey, than last fall? And what about your own personal financial outlook? How is the state's economy looking from your household, from your employment prospects? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And Kevin, before we get to some callers here, some interesting numbers from the survey. People do feel more optimistic about their own personal finances, less so about the state's, more about their own. How do you square those two?
Well, you know, I've been looking at these numbers for quite a long time, and as you know, I think it's been 20 years maybe that we have asked the question if we expect, you know, if folks are expecting that they're going to be financially better off now than next year than now, and for the most part, they're definitely positive numbers. That we are an optimistic people, and we, in fact, sometimes it's not a good thing. Back in the days when we thought the price of houses wouldn't go on forever, there were a lot of folks who thought things were going to be better in the future, and they signed up for mortgages that they couldn't pay back. And it's because we're so optimistic. So it's not really that surprising to me that's in fact the case. But even during the depths of the recession, you know, people kept thinking that things were going to get better next year. And, you know, you would have half or almost half of the folks saying that. So I look at that as more of an indication that we remain optimistic.
Let's go to a caller. We've got Jim on the line now in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. I just want to comment. I think the state of the state is dismal. It's in part due to Walker and the Republican Party's trickle-down economics. Trickle-down economics is never objectively demonstrated to work. And what he did is he took a structural surplus and has created an enormous structural deficit because of his tax policies in comparison to Minnesota, where Minnesota tax policy is progressive on the upper income while we're giving millionaires a holiday. And as a result of this, our state budget is blown, and he's forfeiting the future, particularly in education.
Jim, thanks for the call. A lot there to get into, Kevin. First of all, tax cuts as an effort to drive the economy. Jim mostly talking about tax cuts at the higher end of the income scale, what people call supply side or trickle down economics. What do you think about what he had to say?
Yeah, the again, it's hard to say, you know, exactly that the reason why the Minnesota economy looks like it does is because of their tax policy versus the U.S. tax policy, Wisconsin's tax policy. But the fact is that the promises of a booming economy if we reduce taxes just have not materialized, and I think that's been the experience of many states. States where you found coincidence or a correlation between lower state tax rates and increases in the economy tended to be places that had other things going on, particularly, you know, the oil states in recent years. So I think we have a big hole in the budget. I mean, we're going to get some new numbers, I think, tomorrow or not tomorrow, but in the next week or so from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, and they're going to make some estimates about where we're going to wind up. I think the intimation from the State House is that, you know, it's going to get better. We'll see. But we still have a giant structural hole in the budget that we have to figure out. You know, they're going to have to be either cuts or tax increases in the next little while. We can call them fee increases or whatever else we want to call them, but they're going to have to be some changes in what we are planning to spend in order to make the budget balance.
Do you know if Wisconsinites' personal outlook, pretty optimistic, echoes that of national trends? As a nation, are we feeling more optimistic?
Yeah, I was looking at those numbers in the survey, and it seems they're fairly similar, probably within the margin of error, with, you know, the U.S. optimism maybe a little bit higher, but like I say, not outside the margin of error. So what we're seeing is fairly typical for the country. You know, as an economist, I always get nervous about, you know, asking people things because you get an answer, but you don't really often know how to interpret the answer. And to me, when you ask people about how they feel, you know, what's their optimism, it's hard for me to kind of really draw any real economic content in that. Although I know that if people are more optimistic, they are more likely to spend, and that does have a positive impact on the economy. So it's, to me, it's more the chicken and egg problem. But I think that the egg here is optimism, and the chicken is is what people actually do it when they're optimistic.
Talking to Kevin Quinn, economics professor at St. Norbert College, looking at numbers from the new St. Norbert survey, the new Wisconsin survey from WPR, WPT, and St. Norbert College. Kevin, one question that has been asked in this survey many times over the years, what's the biggest problem facing the economy? For some reason, around 2008, jobs in the economy really peaked. That was what was on people's minds, starting with the Great Recession.
Shocking.
Is that starting to taper off, or are we starting to think about other things more?
Yeah, I think people are still, I'm scrolling to see if I can find the numbers, but I think people are still concerned about that, obviously. They worry about that. But it seems that there are other issues that are beginning to kind of pop up. And the other thing that's interesting is that you find that how people feel about that depends on what their political viewpoint is. So I think that if you were to ask people, in fact, I think it was education was the most concerning thing to most folks, but if you looked among those who leaned to the right, they were more worried about jobs and the budget and, you know, and tax rates and that sort of thing. So it's not surprising. You know, it's when you have a lot, when you don't have much of something, you worry more about that. When you have more of it, you find other things to worry about.
Take a quick call here from Mary in Partyville. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I feel a little like we're doing okay. My husband and I are self-employed, but we're pessimistic about Wisconsin being able to deal with the health care. If we lose our subsidies from the Supreme Court, Wisconsin has no plan in place. So because of the insecurity regarding health care in Wisconsin, we feel our businesses are under threat.
Thank you for calling, Mary. Appreciate that. Some uncertainty there. There's this Supreme Court ruling, which is still out there, which could upend the Affordable Care Act, which would affect a lot of people. How do you see that playing into general uncertainty, Kevin?
Yeah, there is no doubt in my mind that the uncertainty that exists in the business folks, you know, in the business class, and that's, you know, small businesses, but also up to fairly large businesses. The decision makers in those businesses have been very uncertain. And that's a place where opinion really matters because they make investments based on that. And it's really self-fulfilling. You know, when everyone decides they feel good about something, they all spend money, invest in new markets, invest in new products, expand their factories, et cetera, and it becomes self-fulfilling. When the opposite is true, it's also self-fulfilling. And I think that's what we've seen. I think that media have played an important role in that, and a lot of the folks who are in the business class have listened to sort of one side of the story, and it's been a lot of scaremongering, quite frankly, about, you know, how the world is coming to an end because of the Affordable Care Act, et cetera. Now, that said, this has not been a particularly well rolled out thing, and there's been just uncertainty at every turn, and that has harmed us.
We'll leave it there. Kevin Quinn, thanks for joining us. That was Kevin Quinn, economics professor and dean of the Schneider School of Business and Economics at St. Norbert College.